Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York idles on its green transportation plan. As the state has backpedaled on congestion pricing, it's made no progress on nearly half of its other transit-related climate goals. We chat with Colin Kinneborough, who covers climate and environmental politics for New York Focus, and he's tracking the transportation policies in New York's climate plan. Science Stories with Joe Johnson, the former Fort Jervis science teacher, tells us about the surprising phosphate finding in an asteroid sample. Dark oxygen produced 4,000 meters below the ocean's surface, and the mysterious dark fungi lurking everywhere. Plus, Picasso was right. The Berryville Area Arts Association Young Local Artist Program. Plus, Moving Toward Health with Maggie Fitzpatrick. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The acting director of the Secret Service is on Capitol Hill this hour to testify before a joint Senate panel. NPR's Giles Snyder reports Ronald Rowe will be questioned about the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump.
Senators on the Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees are holding a joint hearing amid frustration among lawmakers. They are expected to press Acting Secret Service Director Ronald Rowe for more information about the security failures that led to the attempted assassination at a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. Rowe took over as acting director just last week following the resignation of Kimberly Cheadle. She stepped down after a House hearing in which lawmakers confronted her. Rowe will be joined by the deputy director of the FBI, which has released new details about the 20-year-old gunman, but says the motivation remains unclear. The FBI says Donald Trump has agreed to be interviewed as a crime victim. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Vice President Harris will campaign today in Atlanta. She'll be joined by rapper Megan Thee Stallion. Harris is opening new campaign offices in Georgia, hoping to reach more voters. She had surrogates campaigning for her yesterday in Pennsylvania. That included Pennsylvania's Governor Josh Shapiro, a possible pick for Harris's vice presidential running mate. He lambasted Republicans for their policy views.
It is not freedom to tell people they can go to work, but they can't join a union. That's not freedom. It is not freedom to tell women what they're allowed to do with their bodies. That's not freedom.
Shapiro was joined at the rally north of Philadelphia by Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Former President Donald Trump says he'll probably debate Vice President Harris, but in an interview with Fox News, he suggested that the event might not happen. Trump was originally supposed to debate President Biden in September before Biden dropped out of the race. Stocks opened higher this morning as Federal Reserve officials began a two-day policy meeting here in Washington. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 176 points in early trading.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell will cap off this week's meeting with a news conference tomorrow. Investors don't expect any immediate change in interest rates, but will be listening for signals of a possible rate cut in September. Stock in Procter & Gamble opened down after the company reported an unexpected drop in quarterly sales. The maker of Tide laundry detergent and Pampers diapers has been offering more discounts in an effort to appeal to more price-sensitive shoppers. Energy company BP plans to spend $7 billion on stock buybacks this year. Despite a drop in profits, AAA reports the average price of regular gasoline has dipped below $3.50 a gallon, returning to about what it was a month ago. It's more than 25 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The mayor of Columbus, Ohio, says his city has been able to foil a ransomware attack that hit 2 weeks ago. It affected city email systems and slowed a computer-aided dispatch system that first responders use. The 911 system remained operational. The Columbus mayor says it is not yet clear if personal information has been stolen. China's men's gymnastics team is attracting flack online in China for missing out on an Olympic gold medal. NPR's Emily Fang reports they made last-minute mistakes in last night's team final, and Japan took the gold.
The Chinese men's gymnastics team had dreamed of winning gold and were widely predicted to clinch first place at the Paris Olympics in the team category. They delivered strong performances and had far outscored their competitors, Japan and the U.S. But in the last round of competition, their lead gymnast stumbled on a landing and fell twice on the horizontal bar. In China, people online criticized the athletes for crumbling under pressure, but others pointed out that very pressure is unhealthy. Many of China's elite Olympic athletes are chosen as children to train at grueling state academies, and they are expected to win medals to boost China's prestige. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Meanwhile, the U.S. men's gymnastic team took the bronze medal in the all-around team event. It's their first team medal in this event since 2008. They clinched the bronze with the performance of pommel horse specialist Stephen Nedorozic. He was the last performance of the night. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Under its ambitious climate plan, New York State is supposed to drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. The introduction of congestion pricing in New York City was supposed to fund the expansion of green public transportation to help meet those goals. With congestion pricing on pause now, New York Focus reports it's not the only setback in New York's attempts to reduce transportation emissions. New York Focus is the independent newsroom doing in-depth reporting on how the state really works, and Radio Catskill partners with them to bring you their investigative journalism. Colin Kinneborough covers climate and environmental politics for New York Focus, and he spoke to Jason Dole yesterday.
Obviously, congestion pricing is the big transportation story that, you know, has consumed the state's attention the last month or so, or almost 2 months at this point, and even before that, of course, for a decade before that or whatever. But it's really exploded since Governor Hochul announced this suspension of it at the beginning of June. And so that kind of has set the stage for a lot of discussion about the state's transportation policy more broadly that I think people weren't necessarily having in this serious of a way. I think with congestion pricing, people have talked a lot about some of the specific projects that have gotten put on pause, upgrades to the subway and to commuter rail, new elevators and all of those sorts of things. We've heard a little bit less about some of the, I guess you could say wider impacts in terms of air pollution and of course climate change, which is, where I come in from, reducing, getting more people out of their cars, expanding transit is a big part of the state's overall climate strategy. And congestion pricing is something that was already sort of seen as baked in when the state, finalized its climate plan in 22. And that was kind of seen as like, okay, we got this on track. So what are the other things we need to do? But then, of course, it looks like we are taking a step back on that one.
Like congestion pricing was cited in the law essentially as, well, here's something that we're already doing.
Right, exactly. And then it went on from there to list, I focused on 35 specific things, specific recommendations of other things that the state needed to do to achieve the kind of emissions cuts we need from transportation specifically to get to the state's wider goals.
And out of those 34 items, only one of them has actually reached completion?
Right. There's only one that is really kind of squarely done. One of the recommendations in the plan was to basically follow for New York to follow what California did and adopt what is known in the lingo as the Advanced Clean Cars 2 rule, which is something your listeners might have heard about, requiring basically all new vehicles sold in the state to be electric as of 2035. I think what a lot of people might not realize is that that actually phases in over basically a decade. So starting in 2026, 35% of vehicle sales in the state are supposed to be all electric or zero emissions. But at this right now, that means electric. And right now, we're really nowhere close to that. So even though this is the one item that is done, at least, the rules are written. we're really not there in practice yet at all. We're at, I think, right now 6% of vehicle sales. So it's kind of hard to see how you get to 35% in 2 years and, you know, ramp up as quickly as the state wants to from there. But that is the one that on paper, you know, is absolutely done. And then the rest are at kind of various stages of in progress of being in progress, are at various stages of progress. Some of them, you know, seem to have been kind of forgotten about so far. Some of them you've had a bill introduced maybe in the legislature, but nothing has really happened to it. In other cases, maybe, you know, the state has given out a small grant or they're working on a study or something. But by and large, I would say things have not really gotten very far with the recommendations in the plan.
You point out that New York actually has the lowest transportation emissions out of any state. But as the state seeks to reduce emissions overall, transportation is one of the biggest contributors to overall emissions. So can you talk about these two slightly conflicting realities? Why New York has a relatively low transportation emissions overall, and yet that these emissions still are significant?
Absolutely. What these two stats really point to me, is how car dependent we are overall in this country, right? And how much of our emissions come from transportation nationally. I mean, nationally, transportation is by far the biggest source of emissions. That's not true in New York, because of New York City and how dense it is, and how, you know, rich of a public transportation network we have. And so, you know, in contrast to much of the country. So even though that that public transit system is struggling, as we all know, it still carries millions and millions of people every day. And that means we have much lower emissions than most of the country, where people drive everywhere to get around. That said, you know, in most of the state, people don't really have an option but to drive to get most places. You know, with that comes quite a bit of pollution. And so we still do have a lot of emissions from transportation, even though it's lower than other states. So, yeah, that's the kind of baseline we're starting from. You know, we're doing better than every other state, but that doesn't mean we've got a clean transportation system by a long shot.
So now that you've looked at these 35 items, you see that they're not all that on track. What does this latest research say to you overall? Like, what have you realized in doing this particular report about where we are with transportation in particular impacting the overall climate goals?
My main takeaway is, you know, I would basically split the goals or the recommendations that are in the state's climate plan into two big categories. One of them is electrifying transportation. So basically, you know, getting more people in electric cars rather than regular, you know, gasoline or diesel combustion engine cars, right, or trucks. So that's the one big pillar. And then the second one is just getting more people out of cars in general, expanding public transit, giving, you know, making spaces more walkable and bikeable and all of those things, so that people, you know, can just get around more easily without polluting, or even without, you know, driving an electric car, which also has, you know, pollution associated with it, if you go up the supply chain, right? So those are the two main prongs of the plan. I think on electrification, the state has been doing kind of lots of little and some not so little things. You know, they've been chipping away at building charging stations, although there have been delays there. They've been, you know, they have put in place that rule we talked about, where all car sales are supposed to be electric by 2035. There's been, you know, some funding for research for electrifying or using hydrogen or other, you know, non-zero emitting fuels in heavy duty transportation. So in trucking, basically, right? Little things like that, but it hasn't, you know, we haven't seen a huge shift in consumer preferences or, you know, in state policy that has gotten more people into EVs. But we are slowly making headway. I think on the other side of the equation, on the, you know, getting people out of their cars, I mean, arguably we've taken a big step back just now with this pause on congestion pricing. And just in general, you know, one of my colleagues, Sam Mellons, has reported on the State Department of Transportation kind of sticking to the status quo when it comes to funding highways, for example. There is some, you know, funding that they get from the federal government, from the infrastructure law that passed a couple of years ago, where they have some wiggle room to spend it on public transit or highways. And there's been a real bias towards highways. And just generally, some of the legislation that the climate plan recommends, you know, that would have to be passed by the Assembly and the Senate and signed by the governor, to basically, you know, encourage people to shift out of their cars and into other modes of transit. It just hasn't really gotten very far yet. So I think that's the stickier area. You know, electrification is hard. There are lots of challenges that come with it. But, you know, when it comes to shifting people out of cars in general, that's a whole, you know, that's kind of a bigger societal shift that is challenging on a lot of levels, even if everyone in the government was, you know, going 100% to make it happen, which so far doesn't really seem to be the case.
What legislative support for the climate plan and especially the transportation recommendations, what do you see as being needed there, if anything?
There's one bill that I discuss at some length in the story that I think is kind of the most significant one to pick up on the, you know, macro, the big picture recommendations in the climate plan as far as, you know, reducing driving. And that is a bill that specifically aims to reduce what's known as vehicle miles traveled. That's kind of our best indicator of driving overall by, you know, 20% by 2050. So relatively modest for a 30-year time frame or a 25-year time frame. That bill did, you know, gain some traction, it seems like, this year. I think it was considered by a kind of top Senate working group, but it ultimately didn't get through. And then there are a bunch of other smaller bills that are kind of in a similar vein. There's one which is not so much getting people out of cars, but maybe getting people out of or encouraging them to use smaller cars, which would be a vehicle weight fee, basically designed to discourage everyone from buying SUVs. And there are a few other bills in that vein, but most of them have been stuck in committee. And when I wrote to the transportation chairs of the Senate and the Assembly, I didn't get a ton of response. State Senator Jeremy Cooney, who chairs transportation on that side, he said, you know, yeah, well, we're looking at the recommendations and, you know, we're going to keep working on this in the next session. And that's about the extent of what I heard. So we'll see if there's more attention next year. Yeah.
And then on the state agency side, again, as you look at these 35 transportation policy prescriptions, you know, different items that you're tracking and the levels of progress, a lot of these are things that, like, you know, various state agencies need to adapt, implement. Where are things on that end? What challenges are they facing? Is there a sort of like inherent kind of cultural lethargy that it's tough to, you know, move a whole agency? Is it a bureaucratic issue? What's going on there?
Yeah, I would say somewhat anecdotally, I have heard that about the Department of Transportation, what you're describing in terms of, you know, maybe institutional inertia. I haven't done a ton of reporting on that myself, so I don't want to comment on that too much. As far as the other agencies, I mean, I have heard, you know, or not just I have heard, but, you know, I went back and forth with a lot of these agencies and, you know, tried to get as much detail as I could on what they're doing on all of these different policy items. And again, I think in a lot of cases, you know, they're starting to study something, or they've put in, you know, a relatively small amount of grant funding. So one of the areas I talk about in the piece is it's a concept known as smart growth, basically trying to promote, you know, dense, walkable city centers that are easy to get around without a car. So walkable, bikeable, where there's public transit accessible, et cetera. And, you know, the state is funding some projects that aim to do that, you know, handing out money to municipalities, but it's on the order of, you know, $2 million a year, which is really not huge. And I think when you're thinking about something as big as urban planning, you know, potentially rethinking how our cities are are laid out, you know, building new public transit systems even, or expanding the ones we have, you know, that can be pretty expensive. That can be pretty expensive stuff. And I just don't think we've seen anything on the level of, you know, the funding, which that would have to come from the legislature, or necessarily kind of just a level of commitment to it that might be required from the state agencies to really move these goals forward.
You're talking about there needs to be a much bigger investment of both actual funds and political will.
Yes, that's pretty much what I'm saying. I mean, the climate plan, it's right there in the plan, right? They talk about historic investments. Those are their words, not mine. So, yeah, I think it's pretty clear to anyone who's watching that there needs to be both of those elements if we're going to get anywhere close to meeting these goals.
In addition to like issues of potential institutional inertia, which is a much better, more accurate phrase than I think I said cultural lethargy, but then there's also just the inertia in the public, among people too, which is, I guess, another prong of this. And we see it in the congestion pricing plan, that there was interesting bedfellows of how people were for or against that just in the general public weighing in on that. What's the role of the public and the public mindset? What does that mean for what we're trying to do here in terms of climate for New York? Especially with transportation, I should have said, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I spoke not that long ago with Julie Tai of the League of Conservation Voters, who pointed out that, you know, transportation is a really sticky area because it involves changing people's habits, and people don't like to be told what to do. And New Yorkers are no exception to that. And, you know, I raised that with a couple of the advocates I spoke to for this story, and some of the lawmakers who are working on some of the bills I mentioned. And the response I got was that, you know, their efforts are designed around changing infrastructure. And if you make it easier for people to change their habits, then often they will. And it doesn't necessarily have to be this huge cultural fight, although we've definitely seen that play out with congestion pricing, which I think was one of the bigger bites at this, that, you know, we've seen it in some time. So I think a little bit of that will be inevitable, but in some cases, I think there may be low hanging fruit in terms of, expanding bus service, for example, adding more, increasing frequency on the same bus line, or, you know, there can be relatively simple things you can do that can make it a lot easier for people to get around without a car, that aren't necessarily going to inspire big pushback, but that can make a real difference.
Colin Kinneborough, covering climate environmental politics for New York Focus. His story is up now at nysfocus.com. Colin, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason.
You can also find that article on our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, science stories with Joe Johnson, and he's getting kind of dark. We'll explain after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like The Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Time for science stories with Joe Johnson. Bennu is a small near-Earth asteroid that passes close to Earth about every 6 years. It was the target of NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission to collect an asteroid sample and bring it back to Earth. Former Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer Joe Johnson talks about the surprising phosphate finding in that asteroid sample, as well as other science stories that caught his eye recently, including dark oxygen produced 4,000 meters below the ocean's surface and the mysterious dark fungi lurking everywhere. Let's talk about Bennu.
Bennu, the asteroid, yes.
Sounds like a Star Wars character or something.
I believe it was named after an ancient god. I can't remember what mythology it was in, though. But Bennu was discovered in 1999, and it's important because it's in the Apollo group. In other words, it crosses the Earth's orbit, so we're definitely paying attention to it. About every 6 years, it has a close encounter with the Earth. And in the year 2182, it's going to have a real close encounter. It's not going to hit the Earth. There's a very small chance it'll do that, but it's going to come pretty close. Now, this is fairly large. It's about 550 meters across. And it's a type of asteroid called a carbonaceous asteroid. It has a lot of carbon on it. And we think that this is a leftover from the formation of the solar system. So it's about 4.5 billion years old.
Wow, ancient relic.
Ancient relic of the solar system, absolutely. But the mission that went to Bennu was the OSIRIS-REx, and it's one of those big acronyms that NASA likes. It stands for Origins Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification and Security, Regolith Explorer. So they called it the OSIRIS-REx. And it collected a sample from Bennu in 2020. And it's actually some pretty cool video, which you can look up online, of it actually kind of running into the side of it and all this material go flying off. And it grabbed about 120 grams of material from Bennu, everything from a very fine dust up to something pebble size, maybe about an inch and a half, maybe 3 centimeters across. And it returned those samples to Earth in 2023. Now, it's important to remember that this is primordial stuff. This was collected in space. This isn't a meteorite that's fallen through the Earth's atmosphere and interacted with oxygen and all the rest of our atmosphere. This stuff is pristine. It's leftovers from the formation of the solar system. So it can tell us a lot about the early solar system, and it can confirm our theories. That's the cool thing about it. It's data that can confirm theories. Now, what was expected, they found carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, fair amount of water in the form of hydrated materials like clay-like materials, stuff that holds on to water, and a lot of very simple organic compounds. This is the building blocks of life. 27 amino acids, which, if you remember, can combine to form proteins. So we're looking at the seeds of life. We're looking at the primordial stuff that the solar system is, you know, and the Earth and you and I are made out of. And what they did not expect to find was kind of the discovery that the article's about. And this was magnesium phosphate. And you say, well, it's a chemical. Yes, but it's a chemical that only forms in water. And so Bennu was part of an earlier protoplanet that apparently had some liquid water on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so it's kind of holy grail stuff, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. So this thing, this larger body did have maybe a primordial ocean. It obviously didn't last too long. And the cool thing about this is that the samples are going out to laboratories all over the world. So stand by for more discoveries about.
And this was a big surprise to the scientists.
The magnesium phosphate was totally unexpected. They had previously seen a little bit of it on Ryugu, which was another asteroid that had been sampled by the Hayabusa probe. And they had seen it, but it was very tiny and it was very impure. This stuff, the crystals, there's micrographs of the crystals you can see, and they're just beautifully shaped crystals, very pure crystals.
And so they're still studying it, or they're getting more, or you said stay tuned for more?
Well, as the samples are distributed to laboratories all around the world with different facilities, different pieces in the material, they'll be talking more about what they're finding in there. It's the organic stuff that kind of excites me, because that's building blocks of life.
All right, we're about to get dark.
We are. The next two stories are very dark.
Dark oxygen first dark story we have. What is dark oxygen?
So the term dark here comes from dark matter. It's something that we know is there. We can detect its effect or its presence, but we can't directly observe it. So dark matter is material in the universe, about 95% of the universe, that we can't directly observe, but we know is there because we can see its gravitational effect. Okay, dark energy is kind of the same thing. So dark oxygen, this was from the July 22nd issue of Nature Geoscience. And it was written by a deep-sea ecologist, a guy named Andrew Sweetman, who works for the Scottish Association of Marine Science. Now, we got to go back in time to 2013. He was a scientist. He was studying the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is off the west coast of Mexico in the Pacific Ocean. Now, this is deep abyssal stuff. This is 12 to 18,000 foot deep ocean bottom. Now, this is, by the way, is probably the least understood ecosystem on Earth. There are organisms down there, and so there's an ecosystem down there. So he was studying the use of oxygen in these deep sea organisms. And what he did was he placed a chamber over the sea floor so that he could trap some sediments in seawater. Think of like a fish tank turned upside down and pushed down on the sea floor. Now he's got some seawater and he's got the organisms underneath it. Now he would expect to see the amount of oxygen, here's where oxygen enters the story, in the seawater decrease, right? Because there's organisms in there, they're using oxygen, and he was expecting to see it decrease. Well, the oxygen increased over time. And he repeated the experiment, and he kept getting the same results. So he sent his instruments out, the stuff he was measuring the dissolved oxygen with, like four times mm-hmm. for them to be recalibrated, thinking, the instruments have to be wrong. This can't be happening. And so he had no explanation for it, and he kind of had to move on. Fast forward to 2021, he's now working for a metal mining group, and they're looking at what are called polymetallic nodules, many times called manganese nodules that many people may know populate parts of the ocean floor. These are metal nodules. They grow about a millimeter per million years as metals precipitate out of the seawater. They contain manganese and cobalt, which people are very interested in for batteries these days, iron, and a lot of other metals. And so they're still wondering how the ecosystem down there works. So he repeats the experiment with new equipment, better equipment, and he gets the same results. The oxygen increases. So he's thinking, well, maybe there's microbes. Maybe there's some organism in there that somehow is producing organism. So they kill all the microbes in the sample. They put in some mercury chloride, which is really, really toxic stuff. Kills all the bugs, kills all the microbes. Oxygen level continues to go up. So he has no clue, still has no clue why this is happening. Fast forward a year to the year 2022. He's sitting in a bar in Scotland.
And where all great discoveries are made, by the way.
Absolutely. I'm very jealous. And he's watching a documentary on deep sea mining. And they're talking about these polymetallic nodules that he'd seen on the ocean floor in his experiment. And what the gentleman on the scientist on the documentary says is he calls them batteries in a rock. In other words, they're making electric current. So they get a bunch of them. They take them in the laboratory. They measure them. They're making about a volt of electricity apiece. And so what's going on here is that they're causing electrolysis. You may remember from chemistry in high school that if you pass an electric current through water and you've got something in there to help it conduct electricity, an electrolyte, that you can actually split water, two water molecules split into two hydrogen molecules and an oxygen molecule. And that's where he thinks the oxygen. He finally kind of solved the mystery here. That's where he thinks the oxygen. So they're going to be studying this in the future.
Well, it kind of overturns the narrative that oxygen is only produced through photosynthesis.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's got some evolutionary biologists thinking, gee, could oxygen-using life have developed earlier than we thought at the ocean bottom where this was happening? Wow. Okay. Now, the important part of this to me is that right now, the International Seabed Authority, I did not know it existed. They're discussing rules and regulations for deep sea mining. If this is an ecosystem and these things are producing oxygen for the critters down there, for the organisms down there, then we could be, by mining them, we could be doing some pretty serious damage to the ecosystem. I think they need to take a closer look at this before they allow kind of wholesale mining down there.
The other dark story, dark fungi.
Dark fungi, yes.
Are these at the bottom of the ocean too?
These are everywhere, literally everywhere, in this room as we speak.
Oh.
So this was from the June 21st edition of Scientific American, and it involves what's called eDNA, environmental DNA. See, when an organism is living in an area, it's constantly sloughing off DNA. You know, people lose skin cells all day long. Fish lose scales. You know, little tiny microscopic pieces of DNA fall off them. So you could, for instance, go to a lake and you could sample the water in the lake and find DNA from every organism in that lake in that sample. And if you could identify the DNA, you could tell what's living in the lake. So this environmental DNA has been a big thing for about 20 years now. And they're specifically now looking at fungi. And what they're finding is that fungi are everywhere. There is fungi DNA everywhere. They have looked in the soil where you would expect it, in the forest and croplands and stuff like that, but in the bottom of ocean trenches, in Tibetan glaciers, the stuff is everywhere. And the thing that is important here is that there's about 150,000 named species of DNA. 95% of the DNA of the of this eDNA they're finding from fungi is from organisms, species that have never been characterized. These are dark fungi because they're there, but we don't know. We've never seen them. We've never grown them in a dish. We've never put them under a microscope. And yet we find little bits of their, little snippets of their DNA out there.
How many of these are they discovering?
I don't have a number of how many different species they've discovered, but they estimate that there's about 6 million fungi species on the planet. We've only characterized about 150,000 of them.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, the biodiversity people are giving these us these numbers. And there's a lot of fungi out there that we can't see. We can't study them. We can't put them, like I said, we can't put them under a microscope and say, oh, that's that organism right there.
Right. So are they species?
They're different species, wow. Sure. There's enough of the DNA. There's enough little of the base pairs to say, okay, this one and this one are from different species. This one and this one are from different species. And they have discovered, from what I understand, thousands of new species. And the kind of the political side of this is that there's a naming controversy going on right now. If I'm a scientist and I discover this DNA, can I name that organism? And can I say I've discovered this organism? If I can't show you a specimen of it, can we truly, you know, name it? So the taxonomy people are kind of fighting with the mycologists right now to see how this is going to work out. They're trying to change the rules, basically.
The biodiversity throwdown happening. So why does this matter?
It's important to remember that fungi are very important to humans. Think about it. Yeast helps us to bake bread and, you know, ferment stuff for alcohol. We get antibiotics from fungi. We eat fungi. We make citric acid with fungi. There's a whole bunch of different uses. So if we discover new fungi, will we discover new uses for them? Will there be new antibiotics? Will there be new drugs, new materials that we can use? Fungi, to me, are really biochemically interesting because they do things biochemically that we have no idea how they do them.
It's amazing. It could lead back to other discoveries, other connections that we're talking about as we talk about everything here.
Science is all connections.
It's all connections.
It's all connections.
Thanks for connecting us, Joe Johnson.
Well, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
At Science Stories with Joe Johnson. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we will hear from Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. And she says just because we don't fully have control over our health, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to be our best every day. We'll talk more with Maggie after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, and her column, Moving Toward Health, is out every Tuesday. Today, she's here to tell us a little bit about it, and the headline is
Controlling the Uncontrollable. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to read your first paragraph because I felt like it impacted me. Health, unfortunately, is not guaranteed. It is a seemingly elusive state we all desire to be in, yes, and it requires a lot of intentional work to come close. As we continue to slowly get better, the goalposts move farther and farther away. Yes, if our health begins to decline, it usually does so much more quickly than we'd like. While we can't promise ourselves to be free of disease, does that mean we shouldn't try? So what led you, I was asking you this, like, motivation to talk about this, because there are some very truthful, meaningful statements in just that opening paragraph that resonated with me, at least.
Thank you. Sometimes I get a little deeper in the way that I feel about health, you know? So that's kind of what happened this week, but, I feel like when things are tough, it makes me think about this concept of health, because I feel like a lot of times, you know, even the concepts that we talk about on here most of the time, they're pretty surface level. We're like running through them. How can I get better at this? How can I get better at this? It's like, you know, this tangible thing, this tactic, this grocery shopping, this exercise, whatever. And all of those things are obviously really important, but sometimes it's important to remember that we're doing all these things because it's important for us to be in a state of, you know, trying to be our best and moving forward, but none of it is guaranteed, right? No matter what we do.
And you relate a story back to when you took the SAT exam two days before your 17th birthday. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I went to go retake that dreaded test and, I was leaving the house and it was a weird morning for me. My mom and my dad were both sitting at the table in the dining room, which is like not an occurrence that would ever happen. So I was just like talking with them before I left the house and I don't know. I didn't really think anything of it. You know, I was like, okay, like going to take my test. See you guys later. Left the house. Drove to Liberty, took my test, and when I came out, my aunt and uncle were outside of the school. And I was like, this is weird. Like, is my cousin taking the test too? Like, I didn't know she was here. What's going on, you know? And they were like, your dad had a heart attack. And at that point, it was probably like his sixth one that he had in the last couple of years. So my initial question was like, okay, like, what hospital is he at? And they, you know, had to tell me that he had passed away. And it was in that moment where I was like, it was very shocking for me because at that point I had fallen into this routine of disease, but not life ending, if that makes sense, right? Like we're just like in this pattern of someone not being in a good state of health, but like things just move on. And then all of a sudden it ended, right? It ended. And after that, you know, I've come a long way since then, you know, have gone through a whole journey of being to where I am now when it comes to my own health and helping other people. But that was really the start of me recognizing that it's really important for us to do everything that we can to work towards living a healthy life and being as healthy as we can be. And we don't get control over it. There's just certain things that it doesn't matter if you eat 100% perfectly, exercise every day, have no stress, sleep, and like you could still, something could still happen to you that you don't have control over, right? But in that moment, you have to really ask yourself, well, am I just going to give up? Like, am I not going to put in the effort? Am I not going to do it because I don't have control over it? And I think that that's not really how we're supposed to live. Like, it's kind of just a personal belief, but I really don't think that we should give up just because we're not fully in control.
You talk about this heart disease in your family, and in fact, your great aunt was one of the first patients in the United States to have a pacemaker.
Yeah. Oh, interesting, wow. Right?
Yeah. Well, and part of this also, what resonated with me out of your column this week was that my family has a history of heart disease as well, and there's an awareness, but sometimes I don't feel like I take a responsibility for it in my own health, right? Mm-hmm. I think, oh, well, that's them. That's not me. But no, wait, it's genetic, Tim. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to pay attention to this.
Actually, that is in me.
Actually,
somewhere.
That is me. You got to pay attention to this.
Yeah, you have to pay attention to it. And this is a hard concept to grapple, I feel like, you know, because it's easy to think about this and say, well, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what I do. It still could happen to me anyway. And one, that's not 100% true, because the measures that we take to live a healthy life can help affect gene expression, and maybe we don't end up with those genetic diseases if we do a good job of taking care of ourselves. But maybe we do. I don't know, right? Like, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But it really comes down to, like, what are the principles and the founding beliefs that you have for your life and the way that you want to live. And I think that even though we can't control being healthy 100%, living a life that moves us toward health is probably a more happier and more fulfilling life than the other.
You also mentioned in the column about all of the ways in which we're encouraged to be unhealthy in the times that we live in. What do you mean by that?
How much time do we have, Tim?
Exactly.
Yeah. This is the other part of it, that it's really hard in the world that we live in to be healthy, right? Like, food is all based around convenience, which is something that I'm personally moving through, is like moving away from convenience and into less convenient foods that make me feel better. And that is really challenging. We're encouraged to sit at desks all day. We're encouraged to, you know, move from thing to thing. We're encouraged to always say yes to everyone. We're encouraged that, you know, busy is a badge of honor and we should be going 24/7. And, you know, so the way the world is set up, it doesn't allow us to be healthy easily. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it doesn't make it easy. And so when you just pile that on top, you really can sit there and feel like, well, what is the point?
Yeah.
But there is a point. There's a point for you. There's a point for your children, for your family, for, you know, breaking generational patterns and habits and just showing up as your best self every day, regardless of what the cap of that is, right? You might not get to choose what, like, how far your best gets to be, but you get to move a little bit closer towards it through the things that are within your control.
There's a, just as a kind of an aside, there's an article in today's New York Times about ultra processed foods and how they dominate the American diet.
They
and
really
the whole
do.
Study that's going on right there. So it's an interesting read. I bookmark for later, but it's also relevant to our conversation today. And you also mentioned that taking steps toward a healthier life isn't going to guarantee you're going to escape all of this, but it's going to help you live longer.
Yeah, it could. We hope it does,
could.
Right?
Yes,
we hope it does. And
put in the work.
I feel like it helps you live more fully. Like, whether or not we can affect the length, we hope we can,
yep.
Right? Usually we can. We get more out of each day when we live in a way that promotes health versus in a way that doesn't. So if we can't promise that we can impact the length, we can at least impact the depth. And I feel like that's really important too.
And also in the greater sense of living a life with purpose. You have a purpose here. You're living that. And then that's making it all meaningful just as a whole.
Yeah. I was seeing a video. I think it was one of the Olympics commercials. And they were talking about how, like, you only get one body, you know, take care of it to the best of your ability. And it's the truth. Like, we only get one, you know?
Yeah. Well, thanks for going a little deeper today in the Moving Toward Health column.
Thanks for having me and letting me.
Moving Toward Health is Maggie Fitzpatrick's health and wellness column in the Sullivan County Democrat. It's on newsstands today or online at scdemocratonline.com. Maggie Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, Picasso was right. I'll tell you more about an innovative program for local artists to showcase their work. This is Radio Chatskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to wjffradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The fight against disinformation is more complicated than ever. And in a record year for elections around the world, it's never been more important. I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. At NPR and this station, we report rigorously on the forces trying to disrupt democracy and provide your community with reliable information. This election year, stand with the facts. Donate to this station today.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
It's Radio Chatskill. Pablo Picasso famously said, quote, "It took me a lifetime to learn to paint like a child."
the Berryville Area Arts Association is giving young local artists a platform to showcase their work through their Picasso Was Right series of arts events. And they'll have the experience of an opening night with their work on display at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance's Krauss Recital Hall on August 3rd, this weekend. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Nick Rose of the Berryville Area Arts Association about the effort to empower and encourage budding Picassos.
Good morning, Nick, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm happy to have you here to talk about your upcoming event, which is entitled Picasso Was Right.
Yes.
And that's going to be hosted at the DVAA in Narrowsburg on August 3rd from 4 to 8 p.m. Can you tell us what this exhibit is going to be about?
Sure. It's in the Krauss Recital Hall, and we wanted to give young people the experience of an opening night and encourage young artists. So this is going to be just for them, and they're going to have their biographies next to their work. People are going to come, and we're hoping they'll share what their process is. So we're really excited about it because there's too few things for young artists.
And how did you become interested in this particular exhibit for young artists?
We actually had one on the other side of the river in the Pennsylvania that was funded by a grant that we had in Chihola. We got a grant through the Sullivan County Legislature administered through the DVAA to do the same thing on this side since it was so successful on the other side. So the parents love it. The kids love it. Sometimes it's like the parents love it and the kid doesn't even want to come. Sometimes the kids love it and they drag their parents there.
Right. But
lots of times when both of them love it, it's really the best. And it really is fun. And I think it's something they remember and it's something that will encourage them to do, you know, to continue.
What inspired this title, Picasso Was Right?
Well, Picasso drew like a kid in his later years.
Yes.
In the beginning, he studied and everything. And I think outside his presence when he was alive, a lot of people would say he draws like a kid. But I don't think that he would have been insulted by that. I think he would have taken it as a compliment because he thought kids were the best artists. He said famously, I have a quote from here somewhere, it took him 4 years to learn to paint like Raphael, but it took him a lifetime to learn to paint like a child.
What does that mean?
I think because you have to unlearn all the things that you learned in the art school, and you have to be spontaneous and have fun and connect with real creativity that's not afraid of being judged or what the art critics will say. And kids never worry about what the art critics will say.
No.
So I think that's why they get some of the best work that we've ever seen. And you'll really be impressed, anybody who comes. We have an exhibit there also that is of Picasso prints, his most childlike ones. And if it wasn't labeled, I don't think people would be able to tell which one were Picasso and which one were our artists that we have.
And I see you have some of the work he did about his daughter, Maya.
Yes, Maya was an inspiration for him. So he was fascinated by how children view the world. And he has maybe 12 or 15 pictures. He did a lot within a two-year period in the 1930s. And we have some of the prints. We couldn't afford the originals because they're millions of dollars each. So we have prints of his work, pictures of Maya, and they're pretty. We like them. But again, it looks like Maya might have drawn them instead of Picasso.
And how were these works selected?
We had painting parties. We had a call for art, just like for adults. And then we had a lot of partners all throughout the county. We worked with the Western Sullivan Public Library. And at each one of their three branches, they had a painting party that they invited children to. Myself and artist friend Claudine Lessinger, who people probably know, went to one that was hosted by the Sunshine Free Library in Eldred. It was so much fun to be there with, you know, and draw with the kids. There was one young woman there. She drew a picture and she called it Old Guy. And she said it was me. And it looked just like a monkey.
Oh, my goodness. And you aren't offended.
No. And then she drew, because I said I was going to draw one and call it a young brat. And then she drew an old guy's house, old guy's yard. So she had that theme of everything she drew that day was old guy. So that was really fun for me.
And are you an artist as well?
Yes. I'm this might be self-serving in a way because I draw like a kid also.
Okay. I got it.
And I'm free of worrying if anybody cares for it or not. My favorite quote, just create art. Don't worry if it's good or bad. While other people are deciding if it's good or bad, make more art. So that's really my philosophy.
And how long have you been involved with doing these community projects within Sullivan County?
I retired from my straight job about in 2015. And right after that, I got seriously involved in an art gallery and the Beverly Arts Association. The Beverly Arts Association was founded long ago by artists, but I made it into a formal 501c3 nonprofit, so we'd be eligible for grants and things like that. And we have a great list of volunteers that do all the work, and I get all the credit. Like, it's funny sometimes because people say, oh, you're such a wonderful person to do this for the community. And I'm really not that nice of a person. I'm having so much fun is why I'm doing it.
Well, that's okay.
I don't think I would suffer and sacrifice for the community. I'm pretty nice if I can help them by accident when I'm having fun. But I don't think I would be like one of those people who, Mother Teresa or anybody like that.
Well, it's a happy coincidence.
Yes. I'm always happy if it's helpful to other people.
Yes. I know you've done a lot over the years and constantly creating a new hook.
Yes,
for an event.
That's what I love about artists, because they don't like to do the same thing twice.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a little disappointing. We had a Mermaid Day parade, and it was really a big success. We had costumes, young people, old people. Everybody was there. Then the next year, I was saying, well, when are we going to do it again? I go, we don't want to do that again. Because the next year, it would have been work for the volunteers. Like, if you have to do it every year, then it's a chore. But if you do something once – no,
okay, that's interesting way to look at it.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
Well, I hope everybody will come to the show, and I hope everybody will encourage the young artists in their lives, because I'm afraid that art schools snuff out more artists than they create, because instead of letting the child follow their own path, teach somebody to paint just the way everybody else paints. And so who would want to do that? Like, we want to paint uniquely the way that you paint. So encourage young people in your life and come to our event on the 3rd.
Thank you, Nick, for all the work you do. And thank you to all the volunteers that help you get the work done.
Yes, and thank you, and to the WJFF too.
And thanks to cultural reporter Valerie Manzi for that. Before we go, we've been telling you about the One Small Step program. It brings strangers with different political views together to record a conversation, not to debate politics, but to learn who we are as people. We've partnered with StoryCorps to bring the One Small Step program to the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. And I want to give you an example of how one of those conversations go. It's an excerpt between Deborah and Larry, who participated in the One Small Step program in Fresno, California.
I oftentimes surround myself with people that think like me, that act like me, that have same political beliefs. So sort of stepping out of my comfort zone. I'm really excited, but at the same time, very nervous.
That's nothing to be nervous about. We're just friends. We don't know each other.
We don't know each other, but we will. What made you want to do this interview today?
I see a lot of problems with people being categorized and not totally understood. You're either a Democrat or Republican, you're a blue or red. And I don't believe that. And that's why I love this program and I like to talk to. Deborah, just to put it out there, you are Asian. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of bias out there. Mm-hmm. And how your culture and ethnicity has affected your points of view on the world?
That's a very good question. Growing up, I despised being different.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It actually wasn't until my first time experiencing discrimination and not understanding how somebody could assume something about me without hearing anything I've ever had to say that I started to embrace my identity as being somebody who's not Chinese, not American, but being Chinese American.
I applaud you. Mm. People that challenge us or abuse us in some way, that it don't matter. Those that do will accept us for who we are.
I hope that more people have the conversations that we've had today, right? Allowing the other person to speak, because they come from a different background. They come from different beliefs. We all carry our own journey of experiences and have gained wisdom that can be shared.
Yeah. We have to be open to what people are saying and respect it after they say it.
And that's an excerpt of One Small Step Conversation. You can be a part of the One Small Step program. Sign up, learn more at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.